The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
Okay, Hanukkah Sameach to everyone. I want to share with you some thoughts about Hanukkah tied into the real self, the true self. I think I would call this moving from the savage self to the sacred self. And how does one really accomplish true simcha, true happiness, through the holiday of Hanukkah? So, you know, whenever I do a talk, I have to honestly tell you that part of the most challenging aspect of delivering a talk is the introduction. And I happen to like to joke around. I love to laugh, and I love to be part of inspiring others to laugh. But it's not always so simple to find a joke that's appropriate. And so thank God for Google. You can find anything you want. So I went online and I Googled Hellenistic jokes. I was looking for some ancient Greek Hellenistic jokes. And I came across some very hysterical Hellenistic jokes, only they were all in ancient Greek, which I don't understand. But I did come across one particular Hellenistic joke that I'm sure the Greeks used to say thousands of years ago, and I wanted to share it with you in the original English. So this is my translation. So the joke goes like this. This Jewish fellow, Moishe Schwartz, he goes to see his Greek doctor, Dr. Antonas Mishugas. And he's 75 years old, Moishe Schwartz, and he asks his doctor, I know this is my annual checkup, and I'd like to just know, what are my chances of living till 100 years old? So the doctor says to Moishe, he says, Moishe, do you like thick, fat steak with fat dripping down it? Oh, no, Doc, I'd never do that. No. So what about ice cream and candy and pies and pastries? Oh, no, Doc, I'm very careful about that, too. He says, and Moishe, what about, like, drinking hard liquor and smoking? No, never touch the stuff. And Moishe, what about your sexual life? Is it wild and crazy? He says, no, Doc, I'm not at all like that. So the doctor turns to Moishe and says, Moishe, why would you want to live till 100? I think that joke really captures very much the difference between the Hellenists and the Jews. Because in the world of Greek thinking, or at least the ancient Greek thinking, the universe is here to satisfy my needs. The universe is here for my enjoyment, for my pleasure, and whatever fits my needs and my interests is what the world is about. And that's not quite the way that you see it. Hanukkah has two different miracles, and they seem to be completely disconnected. One miracle is the military miracle, where you have this very small group of Jews who are not at all experienced in warfare, and they successfully beat the mighty Syrian Greek army. You have to understand, in those days, Greece was the superpower of the world, just as perhaps many Americans and probably America itself believes that it is the superpower of the world. You have to understand that in those days, Greece was the superpower. Right? And that's pretty amazing when you think of it, because what's really left of Greeks? Right? Greek salad. I mean, what makes Greeks famous these days? What's left of the Greeks? We're still here to tell the story. How many Greeks are left? What story are they telling? But in those days, the Syrian Greek army was huge. And this very small group of Jews who are very inexperienced in any military maneuvers, they successfully win this war. So that's one miracle, and we certainly appreciate that. Then there's a whole other, apparently whole other miracle that at first glance doesn't seem to be at all connected, which is the miracle of the oil. After we beat the Greek-Syrian army, we go back into the Beit HaMikdash, and we want to reinaugurate the Beit HaMikdash, so we go to find a little bit of oil to rekindle the menorah. and we cannot find any oil. Why? The oil, all the oils had a canister. All oils had this were sealed with the seal of the Kohen Gadol. Okay? Now imagine how crazy or sick these Greeks were. They went into the Beit HaMikdash, they intentionally opened up all the canisters and put their finger in it to contaminate the oil. Like, can you think of anything more ridiculous in your life that that's something that interests them, something that's important to them, that they would intentionally go into the Beit HaMikdash? One thing to destroy it, one thing to put idolatry in, I don't know, but to intentionally go around and try and find all the oil and put your little finger in it to make sure it's contaminated, not for the pure use of the temple. A very strange story. But anyways, the Jews, and it itself is considered to be part of the miracle, they actually find one little canister. But that canister only contains enough oil for one day. And it will take at least 8 days to create new oil, to get the olives and to crush the olives and whatever. The miracle is that that one canister of oil lasts for 7 more days. Okay? So here are two very strange miracles. One is a military miracle, and one is a very bizarre supernatural event where oil that should light for one day ends up lighting for 8 days. But when you think about it, really what seems to capture the imagination, what graphically do you see all over the place for Hanukkah? It's about the oil. It's about those lights. It's about latkes. It's about, in Israel, sufganiyot, donuts. It's about breaking out in all kinds of skin stuff. Who knows what it's about, right? But the whole thing, the oil, it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the military thing. But I want you to understand, there's something even more disturbing. Military miracles, I can understand. The Jewish people are threatened. The Jewish people are oppressed. They are being dealt in the most cruel way. And I'll explain to you in a little while what exactly did they have to bear. But this thing about the oil seems to be a completely unnecessary miracle. Because according to Jewish law, if the Beit HaMikdash, if the temple is unclean, if it's impure, then you're allowed to do the service in the temple in a status of impurity. Right? Of course, the idea would be to do it in purity. But if you can't do it in purity, then you don't just cancel whatever goes on in the temple. You go ahead and do it, even though it's not the best. So I want you to understand, this miracle of the light going for 8 days was unnecessary halakhically. It was a luxury. Right? We would have lived, we would have survived, we would have even been able to continue our regular daily service in the temple until we crushed new oil and refine or repurify the temple. What was so important? What was so important here? So I want you to understand. When you think about it, what is it about the Jewish people that so bother so many in this world? Why is it that so many people have hated Jewish people? Why? All right, we have left and right throughout history, this has not been a merry-go-round, right? There seems to be always a new enemy, just as we say on Pesach, right? L'chol dor v'dor, omdim aleinu l'kaloteinu. In every generation, there's always some new Russia, some new evil person who is trying to get us. Why? What is it about us that annoys people? You know? It's the strangest thing. I mean, do we look so different? You know? When I was growing up, I didn't look like this. I mean, I had red hair, but I didn't have the beard and the pants and the whole thing. I grew up in a completely non-Jewish neighborhood, right? And I looked more Irish than I looked Jewish. And yet, I was beat up for being a Jew. What? How did they even know I was a Jew, right? What really bothered the Greeks, and this has been consistently throughout history, what bothers so many people about the Jews is that we are really, in essence, party poopers. That's what we are. We spoil the party. If you're in a world that wants to act in the most freest way to do what I feel like doing, when I want to do it, how I want to do it, I want a life of no limitations, it's annoying to have Jews in your neighborhood who believe that there's a God, who believes that this world isn't just simply here for your pleasure and your enjoyment, but you come to this world because there's certain obligations that you have to fulfill. And people who are committed to sacredness and purity, it's annoying. Right? It's annoying. Nobody likes to be around what they call a goody-goody two-shoes. Now, I don't know why they're called goody-goody two-shoes in the first place, because who has one shoe? Well, I don't know what a goody-goody two-shoe is, but you get my point. I remember when I was not into my Judaism, my family would go to shul three times a year. 2 days for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. That was my Jewishness. So I remember one Yom Kippur, was in the shul that we went to was not an Orthodox shul. The rabbi got up and said, "We are about to open the ark. And it's customary that when the ark is open, we should stand. However, the ark will be open for a very long time today. So if you get tired, you can sit down." So I'm thinking to myself, I mean, I only come here three times a year. And if all I have to do to get God off my back is stand, I'll do anything he wants me to do. Just lay off me for the year. That's why I went to shul on Yom Kippur Rosh Hashanah. It was like, if I can pacify God, and if this is all he wants me to do, I'll do it. Just lay off for the whole year. Okay? So the aron opens up. Everyone stands as the rabbi says, "Will the congregation please rise?" And we all rise. And then, suddenly I see the entire congregation sits down, immediately, right? And there was myself and my sister standing. And I thought, I can't believe it. They didn't even stand for 1 minute. They're going to go to hell this year for sure. 1 minute, you come to shul three times a year. The aron opens up. Come on, stand. I figured, I'm going to stand. How long could it be open? I mean, really? Okay, so I'm standing there. And I'm in so much pain. My feet are killing me. My back is killing me. And this aron HaKodesh, this ark is not closing. Right? And now you feel like a total idiot. Because the whole congregation sees you and your sister standing. Out of 600 people, just you and your sister standing. Now you're going to look like the idiot. You give up. So we stood. Finally, they close the Aron HaKodesh. And I dropped to my seat. You know? Only today I realized that the Aron HaKodesh doesn't have to be open for so long. The problem is that Chazan, he's got those very long... That's what's so long. It doesn't have to take so long. This guy has, I don't know what's going on with this guy. So, the next day, I'm in school, and I grew up in Toronto, and I went to a Jewish school that was not a Jewish school. It was Jewish, highly Jewish populated school, but it was a secular, not Jewish school. So I get to my locker, and the fellow who had his locker next to me, when he sees me coming, he pulls his hat out of the locker and looks at me with anger and says, "You have to stand!" He slams his door and doesn't talk to me for the rest of the year, right? Why? Because this guy Joey was sitting right behind me in shul. And the whole time I was making him feel so guilty that I was standing and he was not. You see, nobody likes people who make them feel guilty. I want you to understand that the Jewish people, they manufacture guilt in the world. Right? We're very good at that. Right? We're very good at that. You know, in a certain way, it's a little too much, but sometimes you need guilt. You need to know that you're responsible for your behavior, and you can't just do whatever you feel like doing. And you know, Freud did not have such nice things to say about Moses, because in many ways Freud believed that Moses was the founder, right? He's got his patent on guilt, right? And people want to live in a guilt-free world. They want to live in a world that functions like animals. Animals have no guilt feelings. If a lion devours a lamb, does he feel bad about it? Does anybody give him some mustachios and say, "You know, you really shouldn't have done that. I mean, it was really inappropriate." I mean, like, I'm a lion. I can do what I want. You know, it's the survival of the fittest. This is the rules of the jungle, the laws of the jungle. I can do what I want. Okay. I want you to understand that really this has been the theme of the Jewish people throughout history, that we make people feel guilty. We make people feel guilty. And they feel uncomfortable with their lifestyle when they're beside somebody who is committing themselves to a life of sanctity, a life of purity, whereby they believe that there's certain things that are off limits, that you simply are not there for your use. I want you to understand that the Greeks were not so different than the Germans, the Nazis. Of course, one huge difference is that the Greeks did not try to kill us. They tried to kill our spirit. They tried to kill our culture. They tried to kill our Torah. But they didn't try to physically kill us. And obviously, Nazis, the Hitler did. But I want to read to you something from Mein Kampf of Hitler, which really not only captures a deep understanding of why the Nazis hated us, but really it goes back to why the Greeks hated us. It's very simple. It is true. We are barbarians. That is an honorable title to us, says Hitler. I free humanity from the shackles of the soul, from the degrading suffering caused by the false vision called conscience and ethics. The Jews have inflicted two wounds on mankind: circumcision on its body and conscience on its soul. They are Jewish inventions. You get it? He's so clear. He understands exactly what's going on. What are the inventions of the Jewish people? Circumcision on our body and conscience on our soul. These are wounds. Imagine, Hitler is saying we are barbarians, and that's an honorable title. Don't get in our way. Don't try to convince us that we can be all holy, sacred, selfless. No, we're barbarians and we should be proud of it. Continues Hitler, going against nature brings ruin to man. It is only Jewish impotence to demand that we overcome nature. Hitler understood us, I think, sometimes more than Jews understand themselves. This has been the message of the Jewish people from the very beginning. Because one of the most central teachings of Judaism is we can surpass ourselves. That we can transcend our nature. That we are not simply intelligent animals. Mankind has been trying to define himself, herself, since the very beginning. What are we? Are we animals? Are we evolved animals? Are we tool-making animals? Are we intellectual, sophisticated animals? But nonetheless, we're animals. And the Jewish people say we're not. We're souls. There is an animal side to us. The Midrash says that we are part soul. We are part animal and part angel. And the part that is angel has to ride the beast. So I want you understand here that there is a serious philosophical difference between the Hellenists and the Torah Jews. The Hellenists believe that the universe is founded upon wisdom, and only that which makes sense, only that which is logical and rational can happen. And the Jews believe that the universe is founded upon will, which means even if something doesn't make any sense at all, it can happen. Because God created the world the way He wanted it, and whatever He wants, He can do. And that was completely unacceptable to the Greeks. The Greeks, they had an incredible love for art, science, music. So did the Nazis. The Nazis were able to take Jews and gas them to death to the most incredible music. Right? Most incredible music. That's one of the challenging things about how Germany and the sophistication of a country that was so technologically evolved, so evolved philosophically, so evolved in culture, and yet you see that as culturally sophisticated human beings can be, they didn't get rid of the inner beast. And there's still a savage self. The Jewish people believe that the very essence of the human being is a sacred self. And yet we are challenged with a savage self that we can get on top of, that we can take control of. That's an important distinction between the Jews and the Hellenists, as well as much of hedonistic thinking of the world today. Is the world simply there for my pleasure, for my enjoyment, for my satisfactions? Is everything free reign? Is there anything that's off limits to mankind? Is the only criteria for what's right and what's wrong is what satisfies my needs and my interests? Or is there times and situations where my needs and my interests do not determine what's right, and one must transcend their need for satisfaction to do what's right? So the Greeks also had ethics. They had ethics, but their ethics was based on a practical consideration of how we can all get along together. Because if I kill you, then you'll kill me, so that's not going to work. But that's not Jewish ethics. Jewish ethics is I do good because it's good, even if it doesn't feel good to me. Even if it doesn't feel like in the total best interest of me, I do good because it's good. That's the difference between holy ethics and practical ethics. I remember one of my students told me that his father, he believed, was one of the most ethical people he'd ever met. And he did not believe that if his father were to study Torah, he would have been any more ethical. So I said to him, but do you think your father would have been holier? So he was a little surprised by that question. I said, I want you to understand, people make a mistake and think that we live and learn Torah in order to be ethical, and that's not true, right? We do not learn Torah to be ethical. You should be ethical before you even start learning Torah. It's called Derech Eretz. It says Derech Eretz Kadma LaTorah. Derech Eretz is before you even learn Torah. To be a mensch, right, that's not. You should be a mensch before you start learning Torah. And if you're not a mensch, studying Torah won't necessarily make you into a mensch. To be a mensch, that's not the goal of Torah. You should already be a mensch. To be holy, to live a sacred life, that's the goal of Judaism. Now, you cannot live a sacred life if you're unethical, right? You can't achieve holiness if you're not a good person. But one could be a good person, one could be ethical, and still not reach the higher status of being sacred, which soon I will explain to you what that really means. The Hellenists could not stand the concept of sacredness. Because as I mentioned before, sacredness means saying yes to a no. It's an affirmation that there are things that are out of bounds, off limits, forbidden. I can't do it as much as I would love to do it. I just can't do that. Right? And we are not allowed to just give unbridled release to our nature. For the Greeks, the natural is what's beautiful. And therefore, doing anything against nature, just like Hitler said, when man goes against nature, it brings ruins to mankind. And Judaism says, no, if man simply flows with his nature, from an animalistic nature, then that brings ruins. We have to transcend sometimes our nature. That's what it says. Miha Gibor, who is truly strong, Hakovish Yitro, someone who can capture and conquer and harness their inner beast. Yes, there is an inner beast, but I'm not the beast. I am a soul. That's my true self. I am a sacred soul. So that's the difference between holiness and living the life of a beast. If an animal has water in front of it and it's thirsty, that animal will definitely drink that water. But a human being who's thirsty and has water in front of him or her might not drink it because it's Yom Kippur. And therefore, even though I want to drink it, I won't, because there's a higher consideration, and that consideration is my relationship to God. And that just totally That just totally freaked the Greeks. Yeah, that sounds good, freaked the Greeks. Okay, that was totally, that's ridiculous. That's crazy, what kind of lifestyle? And it made them feel right about themselves. Made them feel guilty about their lifestyle. So, if you don't like the goody-goody two-shoes around you, if the guy beside you is holier than you, and makes you feel rotten about yourself, right, makes you feel guilty about what you're doing, you gotta get rid of them. So this is the idea. The idea is, for the Greeks, nothing's sacred. And doing what comes naturally is important. That's why during the times of the Greek, it was acceptable for a person to excrete in public. I mean, that's crazy. People would actually relieve themselves publicly. Because what are you talking about? This is natural. Does he hide? You know, he goes to a lamp and he does his little piddle over there. He's not ashamed. Why should I be ashamed? Take me as I am. This is who I am. This is a philosophy that continues still today. I'm not the people are piddling in the street, right? But some maybe will be. I don't know. But the idea here is that does what comes naturally, is that necessarily good? Is that truly an expression of who I am, my real inner self? Right? Judaism is not against nature, but Judaism claims that you have a higher nature, a nature that belongs to the realm of transcendence, a nature that belongs to godliness. So I want you to know, the Midrash says that the Greeks wanted the Jews, it's a very cryptic Midrash, the Greeks wanted the Jews to write on the horn of an ox that we Jews do not have a portion in the God of Israel. What's that supposed to mean? Like, why would Greeks want Jews to write on the horn of an ox that we don't have a portion in the God of Israel? What does that mean? Well, I don't take this just literally, but it's giving us a very deep point of what the Greeks were trying to do. What is the horn of the ox? It's chet ha'egel ha'zahav. It's the sin of the golden calf or the golden ox. And they wanted us to write on its horn that we don't have a portion in the God of Israel, which means we don't have souls. Because your soul is considered to be a part of God. That's what a soul is. You, to God, is like a ray of light to the sun. An expression, an aspect of the sun. And the Greeks wanted the Jews to say, we are no different than you Greeks. Right? We don't have souls. We don't have a transcendental self. We are animals, you are animals. The Greeks wanted the Jews to say that when we did the sin of the golden calf, that was a true representation of who we are in essence. Right? That's the whole point. Right? Judaism says that when you sin, when you do a crime, that is not you. That is not the real you. Right? You have failed. You have strayed. You have missed your true self. But your true self feels and craves to feel connected to God because you are connected to God right this very second. And there's absolutely nothing you could ever do or say or think that would disconnect you from God. There's a lot you could do and say and think that would convince you that you're disconnected to God. That would give you the experience of disconnect from God. That you can do lots of things to create a feeling of disconnect. But in essence, ontologically, you are always connected to God. And the Greeks said, that's ridiculous, you're not connected to no God, there's no supreme God that could care less about you, that's involved in you, life is nature, this world was, it is, it will always will be, and we are part of nature, and we are no different than the animals, except we are the more sophisticated animals, we're the most evolved animals, but doing what comes naturally is the healthiest way to live your life. And you Jews are wrecking the planet with your highfalutin aspirations for holiness, with your highfalutin philosophy that you're connected to some supreme being who's actually interested in you. So for the Greeks, nothing's sacred, and for the Jews, everything's sacred. Albert Einstein once said there's two ways of looking at the world. Either nothing's a miracle, or everything's a miracle. For the Greeks, nothing was a miracle. It's all nature. Nature is a manifestation of wisdom, rationale, logic, and don't expect any sudden, radical, extraordinary things happening in history or nature. And the Jews believed that everything's a miracle. That whatever's happening is always the will of God and only the will of God. And what seems to be the way things are don't necessarily have to be that way. There's three ways that one could look at nature. You could look at nature's power. You could look at nature's beauty. Or you could look at nature's grandeur. The Greeks could only see the power and the beauty in nature. But the Jews saw grandeur. What's the difference? There's three ways that one can relate to nature. One can either exploit it, enjoy it, or be in incredible awe of it and let it lift you to a place much greater than nature. And that's the difference between the Jews and the Greeks. The Greeks saw nature and inspired them. They wanted science. They wanted art. Because nature was there for our pleasure. Nature was there to teach us how to be powerful. And the Jews, they said, no, but there's also something else about nature. There's a sublime dimension to nature. And it's there to give you a sense of awe and to lift you beyond this world. To connect to a God who is both beyond and yet strangely also manifest within this world. So now we can understand why these two miracles, the military and the oil, are actually the exact same miracle. In fact, the military victory would not be a complete victory if it wouldn't be for that oil. Why? Because that oil is the victory of Jewish culture against Greek culture. Because that oil lighting for 8 days was completely illogical, irrational. Something is coming out of nothing. Here we have oil that can only provide 1 day of light, and it mysteriously, miraculously, this is totally ridiculous. That was the whole point. The lighting of the candles is really the climax of the victory. And every time a Jew lights those candles, we beat the Greeks who live in our age today and today. Because maybe the Greek Empire is no big deal. But Greek thinking, Hellenistic thinking, plagues much of the world today. Is what important to us? Is it about do what comes naturally, just do what you feel, right? Nothing's off limit. Don't feel guilty about anything you do. Just accept who you are, because that's who you are. Or is there an inner self, a deeper I that's connected to an ultimate I that has the ability to transcend, that has the ability to recognize sacredness? Interesting, when we light the Hanukkah candles, we say, Hanerot halalu kodesh hem, ve'ein lanu rishut mishtamesh behem. These candles, these lights are holy, and we have no permission to use them. A Greek would say, that's ridiculous. What's the point of a candle or a lamp if it's not there for you to use? This world is here for us to use it, for us to enjoy it. And here the Jews say, no, there's certain things in life that are off limits. They're off limits. Why are they off limits? Because they tell us that we're connected to a being greater than ourselves. They tell us that the world is not founded simply on wisdom, but founded upon the will of God. This is the famous story of Rabbi Hanina ben Dusa. His daughter went to buy oil for Shabbat candles. And she mistakenly bought a bottle of vinegar. Minutes before Shabbat, as she's pouring the bottle, she realizes that this is vinegar. And she begins to cry because she realizes she will not be able to light candles, Shabbos candles. Her father comes in and sees his daughter distraught. What's wrong? She explains to him the situation. There's no time to go get oil. He says, what's the problem, sweetheart? He who says oil shall light, shall say vinegar shall light. Light the candles. And his daughter lights the candles of vinegar and they light. Well, if that could happen for Chanina ben Dusa, so what's so great about this miracle over here? What's so great about this miracle is it happened for the entire Jewish people. Not just a great tzaddik. How did this work? How did it work? How did Reb Chanina ben Dusa have the ability to, in some way, facilitate a miracle whereby vinegar would like oil? Because for Reb Chanina ben Dusa, nothing's natural. Everything's miraculous. And so the fact that oil lights is no more understandable than vinegar lighting. Why should it light? It's crazy. It's just the will of God. If God wants vinegar to light, vinegar will light. If God wants oil to light, oil will light. If God wants pizzas to light, pizzas will light. What's the, it's all God's will. And therefore, when we light those Hanukkah candles, we have no permission to use them. Just look at them and be in awe. And realize that what looks like a natural phenomena of oil burning is actually a supernatural phenomena. Of at this very moment, God is saying, let these lights light. And they did light. The real victory of the Jewish people over the Hellenistic Greeks was not just a military victory, because this was a spiritual war. The Greeks, in the name of nature, waged a war against holiness. Waged a war against the sacred self. They wanted to preserve the savage self. Sophisticated savage self. Yes, we are sophisticated. Art and music and science and philosophy and ethics. But bottom line, right? This is all about us. Just like an animal. It's all about what I want and what makes me feel good and what works for me. Do you know that the Greeks, everything relating to Kadosh, they interfered with. They didn't allow us to learn Torah, which is of course one of the greatest, holiest acts that one could do. They didn't allow us to do circumcision, which is referred to as Brit Kodesh, the holy circumcision. They didn't allow us to sanctify the new moon, which is called Kiddush HaChodesh. As well as they didn't allow us to celebrate Shabbat, which is again Kodesh. As well as, and one of the most cruel things that they did to the Jewish people, is when a woman would get married, right after the chuppah, she had to go and have sex with the Greek governor. Here is this pure girl. She just finishes her chuppah, and the first man will be a Greek governor. Why did they do that? And if they wanted to do that, why couldn't they do that before the chuppah? Right? Why is it more important after the chuppah? Because they wanted to destroy family purity. They wanted to destroy Kedushin. Because Kedushin means when a man is Mekadosh a woman, he says, you are mine and I am yours, and we will be committed to each other. And even though perhaps we have drives to be with others, we won't be with others. Right? We won't be with others because we are committed to each other. That the Greeks said, that's just ridiculous. Right? Love is free and natural and orgies and all that stuff. This is our victory. When we light the Hanukkah candles, we are celebrating the victory of sacredness over savageness. We are celebrating the victory of the power to transcend nature over nature. We're not against nature. We love nature. Nobody's against nature. Right? But we believe that there are times where we can and must transcend our nature, because there is a higher nature within us, which is supernature, which is the soul. Because the soul is a part of God. Now I'm going to open up the floor and you can ask me any questions you like about what I shared or any other particular questions you might have that's relatively connected to what I shared. Alright. When we look at nature, we see power, beauty, and grandeur. Grandeur is not the same as beauty. Grandeur is when you look at nature and you get a sense that something trans nature is peering through the foliage, whereby one is sitting before a tree and yet they feel like they're sitting in the presence of God. They know God's not the tree, but there's a presence that goes well beyond the tree, and yet somehow there's a tree. It's very difficult to describe. So the Greeks, they saw the beauty of nature, they saw the power of nature, and therefore science, technology, art, all that is inspired by nature. But the Jews, they look at nature, they also appreciate the beauty, they also appreciate the power, but that sense of grandeur, that sense of the light of God, the Ein Sof, the light of endlessness, that just takes you to a whole new level, whereby on one hand you're sitting in the middle of a forest, and on the other hand you feel that you've been lifted to some other dimension. And it's impossible to describe. It's paradoxical. I'm here, and yet I'm beyond. I'm beyond, yet I'm here. So the Jewish people, we believe that Reshit Chachma Yirat Hashem, the real beginning of true wisdom, is awe, the mystery. And the Greeks weren't interested in any mystery. Their goal was to solve what seemed to be the mystery and make it all make sense. It's called to explain. Explain. I'll give you an example. A number of years ago, my son, when he was about 9 years old, he asked me, "Daddy, why is it that when we call Bubby and Zadie in Toronto from Jerusalem, why is it for us it's the afternoon and for them it's the morning?" So I was very excited because here's my opportunity to teach my son a little bit of science. So I said to him, "Listen, you know, Yehuda, the earth is round and it's spinning." And I realized he's not going to get this. So I took a basketball and I said, "Yehuda, this is the sun." And he went, "Uh-huh, right." And then I took a tennis ball and I said, "This is the earth." "Uh-huh, right, yeah. And you and I are on this side of the ball, and Bubby and Z are on that side of the ball. Now the ball happens to turn around on its axis every 24 hours as it's spinning around the sun." And as I'm describing something which makes total sense, because we learned this in like grade 11, grade 10 science, my son suddenly realizes that I'm not joking. His eyes open wide, his jaw drops to the floor, and he's in total shock. And suddenly, thank God, I had the ability to look at what I was describing with the eyes of my son. That's a moment of awe. You realize that what you just described made no sense whatsoever. In fact, the fact that it made some sense is what makes it even nonsensical. As one scientist once said, what's most incomprehensible about the universe is that it's comprehensible, and that's incomprehensible. And so that's a sense of awe. And that sense of awe takes you to a whole new place. When a person looks at a Hanukkah candle, and all they want to do is, "Well, can I light a cigarette with it? Can I read by it? How can I use this?" Jews say, "No, no, it's not about using it. It's just about staring at it. It's just about being in awe of something that seems so obvious, that seems so regular, that seems so natural, and yet is it?" And the more you look at that candle and realize how absolutely ridiculous and how unbelievable this candle is, the more believable God becomes in your life. So every time we light those Hanukkah candles, we are bringing back to the world a sense of awe. We're bringing back to the world of that which is so precious. It can't use it. You see, nothing's sacred today in the world. It's so sad. I remember Israelite did a Shabbaton in one of the shuls on the west side. We had this beautiful Friday night dinner. And then after this very high spiritual dinner, we walked outside to go home, and here we are walking on Broadway. Wow, what a what a contrast. And I was very, very challenged by it. And I'm wondering, what is it that I'm feeling here on Broadway? And how does it differ from what I felt just inside that shul that I just walked out of? And then I looked up and I saw a billboard. And on this billboard was an advertisement for the latest Broadway comedy called Nothing's Sacred. I said, oh, that's like Rashi commentary on the Torah over here. This is unbelievable. What's nothing sacred? What makes something sacred? Well, there's so much to say about sacredness, but just one thought. Sacredness is ultimate preciousness. Something is so precious. So precious. Imagine we were a golden wine goblet. And we have been designed for the exclusive use of the king, for only the finest wines. But we didn't know that we were a golden goblet. What do we know? Right? Suddenly they start reading to us all the rules and regulations of what we can't do. Right? Well, you can't be in a bar. Why can't I be in a bar? Right? You can't be a mug for beer. Why can't I be for a mug for beer? No, no, no. No, you can only be in the palace of the king. That would seem so restricting. I want to be free. I want to be like all my friends, these mugs and these cups and these plastic cups. I want to be like out there in the world. I want to do what I can do whenever I can do it, when I want to do it. Like, why do I have all these restrictions? The restrictions is a sign of exclusivity, of preciousness. And as soon as that golden mug was explained to him that these restrictions are not to minimize your value, but actually to lift you up to a much greater service. See, Judaism says that serving yourself is the best way to undermine self-worth. When you feel you're serving a greater cause, when you feel you're serving a greater mission, when you feel that you have a purpose, that your life is in dedication of, whereby even your physical survival is less important than being able to bring that mission into the world. That's an amazing thing. I remember I heard an interview with John Glenn, if you remember John Glenn from the friendly, what was it called, the Friendship 7 rocket ship. They interviewed John Glenn just after, I believe it was called, the Challenger had exploded and the astronauts inside were killed. So they asked John Glenn, because apparently the Friendship 7, that first rocket ship launched, did have some very serious technical challenges. And there was a very challenging moment where they thought they were going to lose him, because the heat shield of the rocket ship was starting to break down and it looked like it was going to go up in flames. So they asked John Glenn what went through his mind when he realized that his life might be in danger, and why would he even put his life in danger to go to the moon? Why even do that? Why do something that could possibly endanger your life? And this is what John Glenn said. He said, until you can find a cause that you're ready to die for, you have not begun to live. That's a pretty amazing thing. When you find a cause that is so precious that you're willing to commit your whole life to it, and even the safety of your life, that's when you feel alive. That would be counter-logical to Greeks. That's not what it's about. It's about me, my pleasure, my satisfactions. But what's the difference between an animal and a human being? Animals have needs. But human beings have a need to be needed. Animals seek satisfaction. And human beings seek the satisfaction of satisfying others. When I'm able to satisfy others, I feel satisfaction. It's the strangest thing. Strangest thing. But that's holiness. That's sacredness. That's moving from the savage self to the sacred self. And that's a true self-worth. And that's true self-mastery. And that's truly making eye contact with your real eye. Your real eye is a soul. Right? And you are very different than an animal. And the Greeks really believed that we're all part of nature. And doing what comes naturally is what's important. Any other questions or comments? Right. The Muslims are actually a bit of a different story. Our problem with the Muslims really, really started when we came back to the land of Israel. right? A lot of Jews in Muslim countries had relatively good lives in Islamic countries. The real problem started when we came home to the land of Israel, where we decided that it's time to establish our own state. And that becomes really the conflict. It does become it's a religious war, right? The war between the Greeks and the Jews was not a religious war. You might say it was really the war between a exclusively secular society at war against a religious society. Now, Judaism does not believe that secularism and religion are at odds with each other. Not at all. We actually believe that the secular is like the substance and the religious is the form. Just like a cup, like this cup here. The substance is plastic, the form is cup. But you can't have form without substance. Although you could have substance without form. Well, actually, all substance has some kind of form. It has to have some kind of form. You could have a blob of plastic, but it doesn't have any value. What gives this plastic value is the fact that it's in the form of a cup. So Judaism teaches that the secular world is a substance. The sacred is a form that brings out of the secular its value. I want you to understand that the numerical value of the word Torah is 611. It equals exactly the numerical value of art plus science. The word in Hebrew for art is omanut, and the word in Hebrew for science is mada. When you add omanut and science, which was the epitome of the Greeks, you have exactly 611. Right? But so are they equal? Yes, they're equal in their contribution to the fullness of life, right? Judaism isn't against art. Judaism isn't against science. But when Torah imprints upon the substance of art and science the values and the ideals, otherwise, you know, I mean, you could take some... It's like a friend of mine who's an artist. So he asked me if I could deliver a painting to New York. So I said, well, when I get to customs, what do I tell them what it's worth? He said, the worth is basically $100. Now, his paintings go for thousands of dollars. I said, but what do you mean this painting is not worth $100? He said, no, this is $100 worth of paint and canvas, and that's really what it is. Right? Because the value of art is very subjective. So here's a man who is able to take a few dollars worth of substance and turn it into something that's worth thousands of dollars. That's what sacredness does to your life. Right? Until I began to live a Torah life, my life did not have the same sense of value. That's the whole point of living a life of values. It brings value to your life. Right? And so our war with the Greeks was this sense of the Greeks saw sacredness as in conflict and undermining the success of secularness. And we actually believe that secularness is lifted up to an even greater value when it is subservient to sacredness. In fact, the word Zion, Zion, is made up of two words. The first letter is tzaddik, which is righteousness, and the next three is yavan, which means Greek. Yavan, which is Greece, and tzaddik is Tzion. Within Zion, we incorporate yavan. That's why it says the bracha that was given to Yefet, which basically from Yefet came the Greeks, is that God will bless Yefet with yuffi, with beauty, but in the tents of shame, and we, the Jews, come from shame. When the Jews create the context, when sacredness is the context of music and art and technology and science, then they become part of the holy, right? Rav Kook says there's the holy and there's the profane. And when you unite the holy and the profane, you have something called the Holy of Holies. The Holy of Holies is when the profane, the secular, and the sacred are united. The Greeks saw in their either-or thinking that it's either sacredness or secular, either transcendence or nature. And one of us has got to go, right? The Jews believe no. There's a time for naturalness, and there's a time for supernaturalness. Our war with the Muslims is not about that, right? This is actually how you define sacredness. This is really about who's really the chosen people. Because Muhammad claimed that he is the flowering, the fruition of the Mosaic prophecy, right? And so too with Jesus. Jesus claims, or his followers claimed, that he was the fruition, he was the flowering, the fulfillment of the Mosaic prophecy. The Islamic people, millions and billions of them, the Christians, million and million, they all agree that the Jewish people got the Torah at Sinai. They all believe that. But what they say is that we have sinned, and we have lost God's favor, and that they now are the chosen people. That's a different war. That's a whole different thing. Okay? I'm talking about, you know, that's why I said that Nazism was not about religion against religion. It was about nature against supernature. It was about going against nature brings ruins to mankind, and therefore the goal is to live the most natural life. And Judaism says the goal is to live the most supernatural life, which includes nature, but sometimes we must and can transcend our nature. Any other questions or comments? Right. The real question between the Jews, the Christians, and the Muslims is who are the chosen people? Now, I'm actually going to be giving a talk in New York in the next couple of weeks on the chosen people. So I mean that's a total different topic, but since you're asking the question and since I brought it up, so I will address it a little bit though. The chosen people does not mean elitism. It doesn't mean we're better than anybody else. Chosenness is not a privilege, it's an obligation. It's a responsibility of leadership. It's a responsibility of being a model of inspiration to other people. Okay? That's what it means. It doesn't mean you're better. Okay. The Bible teaches that the Jews were chosen by God to lead a revolution in the world towards true sacredness. Right? The Christians as well as the Muslims believe that there was an Abraham, that God spoke to Abraham. In fact, the Muslims call their children Ibrahim. That is a common Islamic name, Ibrahim, which means Abraham. However, they believe that the Jewish people were not the true descendants from Abraham who merited the chosenness, and that they, the Muslims, are actually the chosen people. Okay. The Christians also, I can't say all Christians, but the Christians in general, the attitude is that we are the new Israel, and that the Jewish people have sinned, because they did not accept Jesus as their Savior. And therefore, because they sinned, they lost their chosenness. And those who are devoutly committed to Jesus, they are now the new Israel. And the Jewish people say that that's actually not true. It's not a question of right or wrong. It's a question of the Christians are not the chosen people. They're good people. They're great people. That's not the issue here. The issue is, what is the role of the Jewish people? And is it because if the Jewish people did not accept Jesus, does that mean they lost God's favor? Judaism says no, that does not mean that they lost God's favor. But this is probably a much longer talk than I think we need. Okay, let's take one more question and then we'll wrap it up for Hanukkah. Of the lighting of the candles, it's by looking at the candles as if you never saw them before. You could do that. Just don't look at them as if you've seen these things before. Just look at this little flame as it's emerging from a wick, which absolutely makes no sense whatsoever. This wick is not burning, yet there's this flame over here, and somehow the physical is actually supporting, which is the beautiful thing about the flame, is that the physical is supporting and facilitating the spiritual, which is light. Light is emanating out of the physical. You have oil, physical, you have a wick that's physical, then you have flame, which is kind of quasi-physical, but you can't quite grab it, hold it, doesn't exist on its own. So that's already a next stage out of physical. And then there's a kind of aura. If you stare at a candle, you'll see there's an aura around the candle, which is even more spiritual. Then you realize that there's light that you can't see, but it's this light that's actually lighting up the whole room. So just by staring at the candle and meditating on that candle, that should give you a buzz. And I appreciate you giving me this opportunity to teach from Jerusalem here from my office, literally minutes away. Not even 2 minutes from here is the Western Wall. And I invite you to come to Israel. Okay, shalom and Hanukkah Sameach.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.